19 March. I'm not familiar with this Jupiter.
Oh, they would, I guess, from somewhere in 64, I guess, they started doing intensity interferometry on Jupiter using tape recorders.
I see.
And sending, I think they were Smith. Getting the LO, yeah, that's right, Smith and Carr, they were getting the LO from WWV, and you could just use a tape recorder like this, a few kilohertz bandwidth, and Jupiter was so strong, it was no problem. And, but then, as I say, a lot of people, I think, had probably thought of it earlier. And then just around the mid-1960s, all of a sudden you had tape recorders that could give you enough bandwidth to detect extragalactic sources and commercial frequency standards, which were good enough to maintain coherence for some, at least some tens of seconds. And the when we realized that you could do it, I mean, with existing equipment. And the really big advantage we had, which no longer exists at NRAO or probably anywhere, and I remember going into Dave Heeshan in September or something and spending about 5 minutes total describing this thing and, you know, what it would take to do it. And he sort of opened up a book and said, well, he said, how much did it cost? And I said, well, it looks like it would be about $100,000 to develop two recorders and everything. And he looked in a book, and this is in September, and he said, well, we can't spend more than $50,000 on it during this year, before, you know, up until December. Will that be enough until December? And that was it. And a week later, I saw him in the hall again. He said, what have you done? I said, I haven't seen any, you know, we haven't spent any money or anything. And it was just because, I mean, if we had to go through ordinary channels of writing proposals and applying for grants
or
whatnot.
Or a university administration.
Yeah, it would have been years. Right. Is it? I mean, NRAO had this budget for new projects and new ideas and whatnot.
The
there it was.
This is late 65.
That's right. And then we got, you know, aware of the Canadian project talking or anything. We went in pretty different directions because they developed an analog. They had these surplus TV recorders and they did analog recording,
right.
Which is much more difficult. But they ended up with a larger bandwidth. And we initially had the digital recording just using computer tape drives, which was much more straightforward. Although
in terms of the
timing, less efficient anyway. Well, we didn't have to. We didn't. They had to have their tapes aligned to within a microsecond or
right.
So. We didn't, because we could just buffer the data in a digital
and look for fringes.
Yeah.
And so the timing was such that they got fringes first.
By a few weeks, yeah.
Only by a few weeks.
Oh yeah. Let me see. We each did a. Well, we were too ambitious. Our first experiment was between Green Bank and Arecibo, and there were no results. And then, and their experiment was between Penticton and ARO or something. And I guess there were no results on that. And then they dropped back to a baseline between Ottawa and some suburb of Ottawa or something. It was some, I don't remember, some tens of kilometers or 100 kilometers or something. And we dropped back to Green Bank to Maryland Point. and then they got fringes on their short baseline a few weeks before we got fringes on our short baseline. And then they immediately went out to Penticton, and we went in the direction of the we were both at that time much too conservative about how high in frequency you could go with the present existing frequency standards.
That was in 66 or so.
That's right. They went to 75 centimeters. We stuck our necks out, tried 50 centimeters. And then we quickly jumped to 18 and did stuff to Green Bank to Haystack. And then it was all continuum. The whole stuff had been built up for continuum work. And then as about the same time that all the tense OH lines were discovered, and the major concept, and the idea that those should be very, very small. And Jim Moran...
Who was the one that really pushed the OH VLBI? Was
Jim Moran.
Was it him? He not Burke?
Well, the two of them, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a student at Burke's, but he did all the work.
Yeah, right. I know he did all the work.
He wrote all the programs and everything to analyze spectral line data.
Did you realize in those first experiments that the technique would prove so powerful? I mean, worldwide and all this sort of...
Yes and no. We wrote, and Gold wrote a paper on these various other applications. I had a mental block, and it's partly because of this, you know, expanding source model, which we lead by the gospel, that all we had to do is measure the size of the source. You know, all you need is a few points in the visibility function.
They'd be circularly symmetric.
Yeah. And if we could do this as a function of time, we'd be able to actually measure the expansion and everything. And so we did Green Bank to the Haystack, and then we went out to Hat Creek, and that was 20 million wavelengths cross country at 18 centimeters. And with only a few points, indeed, you can interpret the stuff as circularly symmetric. And then we were going to go to 6 centimeters at Hat Creek. And that was in the winter of 67.
67,
68. 67, 68.
But why were you believing that when there was quite a bit of evidence for double?
No, there wasn't, not on that scale. That's what I'm trying to say. We should have looked back. We were aware of the conventional interferometry. All those sources were about double.
On that scale, you did.
Yeah, but yeah. They went through the same stages. You know,
right.
In the early days, you had one point of visibility function.
Right.
You gave a size to the source, and then, of course, Cygnus was discovered to be double and everything.
Well,
we didn't take that hint. But I had this mental block.
Yeah.
I just told myself they had to be.
Why did you
even
believe in that model? I never did. I thought it was only and I published it the way I did to stimulate observers so that they'd have curves in which they could plot their points. I mean, they'd have curves in addition to just a two-coordinate plane in which they plot their points.
But
to stimulate them to go and observe and know meaningfully how the observations should be spaced in frequency and time.
Yeah, but
I never expected any source to conform to it.
No, but you believed then, and I did, and I think you and I do now, of the expanding source model. Maybe not quantitatively expanding at uniform velocity, the conservation of magnetic flux everything. But
basic concept, yeah.
The basic concept.
That's right. I mean, of dimensions increasing with increasing time.
Right. And the opacity moving down in frequency. That was in our paper, it was in your thing.
That's right.
We were going to do another, going to go from 18 centimeters to 6 centimeters cross country that winter. And the last minute, Hat Creek, backed out because they said that they didn't want to change receivers in the middle of the winter because they might not be able to change back to 18 centimeters till the spring or something. And by coincidence, the Swede decided they wanted to get involved in that stuff. And Bert Hansen was
largely because of the Maser sources, I suppose, or?
No, they were just interested technically,
in
I think. Technically.
And
Rindbeck, on the spur of the moment, sent Bert Hansen to Green Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And Hein Vadim, of course, had been there and knew him well and everything. So he came over here and sort of said they were interested and we'd like to try an experiment sometime. Well, we just, within a couple of days, had been told, you know, we couldn't do this thing we had planned to Hat Creek.
Did you know they had an 85-foot
dish? Oh, yeah. That we couldn't do this thing to Hat Creek. I said, well, how about next month? I was getting married in Holland then, and I was going to be in Europe.
Great honeymoon. How do you like to go to Greenland for honeymoon?
Yeah, and we did have a real one first, but then we went off to Sweden and did the video. So that increased our previous thing is at 20 million wavelengths from here to Hat Creek at 18 centimeters, and we immediately went from here to Sweden at 6 centimeters, which was 100 million wavelengths. And you found the smaller and smaller sources. But we're still just putting a size on them and everything.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until around 70 or so that the data finally began to strike home the point that the sources were more complicated than that.
Right.
And then, when we first began to realize that you needed lots of spacings and lots of antenna pairs and full hour angle tracks and whatnot.
Just like
and
arc resolution. I just thought of another topic in which I'm sure both of you can make a few interesting comments, and that is source variations. You know, Dent in 65 was the first one to pick up any, but how did this affect how you thought about radio sources? Was it particularly surprising, or?
Because I had been playing around with self-absorption and everything. If you look, read Dent's original paper, he interpreted it incorrectly. Let's see if I remember. He said that, you know, if it's varying, well, and it was at such a distance, you know, the size had to be less than the distance that light could travel during that time, and therefore it had a certain angular size, and that, with that angular size, it should be opaque at that frequency, and it had the same flux, and this was at 4 centimeters, and it had the same flux at 4 centimeters as it did at longer wavelengths, and therefore it wasn't opaque. And what he didn't realize was that the variable component was opaque. And he also had a numerical mistake in the calculations,
right,
which George Field pointed out in the paper.
That's right.
So I, in a way, I believed it more than Dent did. Or that, you know, they really were compact sources. And that's where, see, that's where I should have said that before. That's where the whole idea of the VLB stuff came in, too. Immediately, you had the present, the indication that there were sources, that there were sources of 1/1000 of a second of arc.
Yeah.
That's how I got interested in the VLB stuff.
Was it particularly surprising? Was everyone sort of expecting that sooner or later these sources would be found in
there?
No, I don't think so. I think I was completely astonished that extragalactic sources at the distance of hundreds of millions of light years could change in the course of a man's lifetime, let alone a month or a week. It was a wholly new concept. If you think right back to Greek culture, that's something that shouldn't change. And certainly if something could change on the stellar scale, and we knew that you could have a supernova event in a galaxy, but that such things could change was just, now we take them completely for granted, as we do so many stupendous things. But 10 years ago, no.
It would be the same shock now if we saw a whole galaxy change somehow.
That's right.
The optical was a whole galaxy.
But Ivan and I set out to, the 144 was just finished then, we set out to follow some of these, and then there was this tremendous outburst in 66, and in the spring of 66, and in several other sources. And we had observations at several wavelengths, and saw this effect of the peak flux occurring at longer wavelengths at later time. And
that was the first outburst also that established, first showed that effect nicely?
Yeah, it's phenomenal. I mean, there were three outbursts at that time, in 273 and 279 and 454.3. Nothing which has happened since then comparable to that. And so and 3C120, there were three outbursts, or two in 66 and 7 or something. And they were—they all showed this effect. And
you mentioned
it. It was clear the sources were opaque. It was clear that you could interpret it, at least qualitatively, in terms of this of an expanding source. And then Harry showed up and interpreted it quantitatively.
I spent 6 weeks. First, we were actually planning to write a joint paper putting in the theory and the observations. Yeah. But then observations always take longer, and you can't. And Fred Haddock and Jeff Burbage were on the visiting committee of NREO, and they visited here just after I got here. And Fred Haddock came and talked about it. It was clear he didn't understand the variability at all. And then I said, Ken and Ivan and I, we're planning to write something on this because we think that it may have a very simple interpretation and we should really write it up. But finally it was clear I could only be here 6 weeks because I had commitments after that to do something in Canada. And Ivan and Ken were so busy. I don't know, you were going off to some conference over there, Ken.
This is the summer of 66.
Summer of 66.
After the
burst.
No, it was just a vacation.
Whatever it was. Anyway, it turned out to be impossible to write a joint paper incorporating both the data and the simple model. So we decided that I would write up the simple model, which was just really, it's terribly simple. It's just the generalization of Sklovsky's 1960 supernova remnant model.
Right.
Nothing else. It's just flux conservation, triple radio. And I honestly did it with the motivation was mainly not that I thought this is the way the world is, but if we do this, many observers, because Ken and I both realized what we must have, we somehow might need many simultaneous observations at different frequencies, and people have to be really convinced and understand what they're doing or they won't join this bandwagon.
Right.
And this thing needed a bandwagon because it wasn't, observations had to be done simultaneously and were inherently non-repetitive. You couldn't confirm your observation afterwards.
Right.
And realizing all that, we said, we better write it up. So I started sketching the thing. Robin Conway was here and he said, yes, you better write it up. And I wrote a draft and Bill Howard said, yes, you should really do this. Bill said, I know from experience how this helps an observer, stimulates an observer to observe something. It's like Ryle having something to shoot at.
Yeah.
An observer would be just as pleased to disprove the model as to confirm it.
More pleased.
He needed a model. That's the point.
You were playing that role today with the radio source models.
Yes, that's right. So, anyway.
What was the year that you said the extrapolation came out to the end of the world?
It was 2025 or something. 3C273, it was going up 10% a week or something.
Yeah.
Okay,
well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
I should tell you one more thing.
One more thing. Okay, go ahead.
Not about my own work, but about I sometimes think there's a very big discrepancy between how outsiders feel about the Cambridge group and how we experienced it as insiders. I mean, I only became aware of the Cambridge flavor and reputation in the outside world after I left the group.
I see.
Before I went into the group, after all, I knew nothing about radio astronomy, so yeah. Certainly I'd never heard of the Cambridge group, let alone of any reputation about it. I joined it. I found that Ryle was clearly the dominant personality. I don't only mean that he was the strongest character, he was clearly the most widely interested and enthusiastic man. And inside the group, there was a genuinely fruitful research atmosphere. I mean, the group was internally extremely open. We talked about everything, and Ryle was, and that's quite a contrast with many people I know in that kind of position. You know, often when you come to someone...
Well, they all admire him also.
Oh, yeah.
That's many people actually love them. I still am very fond of him. Some people didn't like him, and he didn't like some people. And he was very strong in his likes and dislikes. If he didn't like you as a research student, I mean, you were in a very tough spot. He would really discriminate against you. But we got along famously. And, well, he always had... If you had something, at least I'm the kind of chap, if I have an idea, I have to discuss it with someone. And I often walked into Ryle's office and interrupted him. Hmm. And he would listen and be genuinely interested. And if he just couldn't afford the time, it would be... He was obviously pained that he had to write some reports or a letter, because he'd much sooner listen to you. He conveyed that impression, and I think it was authentic. Mm-hmm. And that was a tremendous stimulus. I mean, he was genuinely interested and enthusiastic. And I only realized after I left the group that the group had a somewhat narrow-minded attitude towards the outside world. And in retrospect, I can see that maybe I was just naive. One could have detected that earlier, because I know that Ryle did sometimes fairly explicitly warn us that if some visitor were coming in, I remember once Mort Roberts was visiting us, that we shouldn't give any information away. Although he did say explicitly, and I think that's rather nice, he said, look, we have very little money. He once said to me, he says, NRAO's got more money for his cafeteria this year than we have for telescopes. And he says, now if this visitor is not capable of asking intelligent questions, don't give him the answers to questions he should have asked. Okay? But give him honest answers to real questions. But don't volunteer a great deal of information, because, look, you know, we have to be clever, because we're not rich.
Yeah, yeah.
And we understood that, we accepted that. Only in retrospect do we understand that this really often took on pretty extreme forms.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm not sure if it was so bad. I didn't realize it was that bad. I think when I went there, there wasn't this cloak of secrecy, at least.
No.
I was fairly well accepted. And I had a key to the place and worked nights and everything.
Yeah.
And the most fascinating thing was these Saturday morning sessions.
Literature discussions, yes.
Which they would rip each other apart. Well, first he would go through, the people there had their assignments for the week or something they were supposed to do, and they would each report on what they've got done. And each one would get ripped apart as to why he only got one-tenth as much work as they were supposed to do. And then he'd get on to the literature discussions.
But who made these assignments?
Ryle.
Well, no, but John Shakeshaft kept the literature up. So there was a weekly output of new papers to be reviewed, and behind every paper was the name of a research student or a junior staff member.
No, I'm talking about the assignments at the observatory, like fixing this antenna.
Oh, that's right.
And then came the literature part.
They were also assigned. All the papers were assigned. John Shakeshaft did that. And some students wouldn't do anything, and others would say, okay, I'll review my things this week. The question would be, who's got a paper to review? There'd always be something to review. Mm. Often this would take all Saturday morning. But it was very interesting, and Graham Smith and Martin Ryle would cut into you if you didn't give a good critical review, and if you'd missed the essential point.
Yeah, it gets very emotional, too. I mean, I saw cases where some poor student would get up and merely report on what somebody else had said in his paper. And somebody was...
And
obviously
they,
wrong.
They
and then Ryle would jump into him and criticize it, as if it was his
right.
theory or his model.
His mistake. Yes.
Yeah, that's easy to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Baldwin has told me about these Saturday morning sessions and how.
And then poor old McVitie came once, and reported on source counts from VRO based on 30 sources, and then went on to say something about the MSH catalog. Oh, he told me, oh, that stuff's all wrong. Forget it. You're not paying attention to that catalog. It was a very lively place. I got an awful lot, aside from doing that spec tour, I got an awful lot of spending that 3 months there. It was really a lot of enthusiasm.
The place was really alive.
Yeah.
And at lunch and at coffee and tea time, which we'd have in the Austin Wing at Cavendish.
Right.
Always talking astronomy, would always sort of, if we didn't have a piece of paper, we'd spill some of our tea or coffee, and we'd draw with tea or coffee on the table. But it was just very enjoyable. Right. So, I mean, in retrospect, and also at the time, I really enjoyed those years, and I think as formative years of research sciences, they were terribly important. And I like to think, I don't know what you think of it, but at Leiden Observatory, we tend to have an atmosphere that is rather akin.
Well, I don't know. I mean, when I spent time there, it was exactly the opposite. It was the dullest place I've ever been. Just before you came. We traded offices, remember? Yeah, we traded all. I stepped out of the office and you stepped
right,
in.
That's right, when I came in, that's right.
I spent 3 months.
No, I think in the last few years, Leiden has had an atmosphere that
I gather it has, but
there's a difference.
It was like a morgue.
It's not a well-defined research group. I mean, you have many different fields.
Well, it's broader. It's an observatory rather than a radio observatory. Yes.
Yeah. That's right. But even in Cambridge, it's not a radio observatory like here. It's radio sources and a few other things.
I know. It's almost, that's right. That's why, in part, maybe because they're so specialized, they also feel they have a monopoly on it. They own Cygnus A, yes.
Yeah.
Is that anybody else doing anything on
it? That's not quite true.
Well, thank you. I'll cut this now.
See, afterwards, Ken Kellerman brought up the very interesting point about why it was that Caltech missed the opportunity to aperture synthesis, because they had the two steerable dishes and an interferometer, and they were the only ones that had such a setup as early as 59 or 60, and yet they did not make the connection of doing Earth rotation synthesis. They did various baselines. They had 10 stations there. They took various position angles in the UV plane, but they never just quite put it together. And all this time, Ryle was fighting like mad with the Science Research Council to get funding for the 1 mile interferometer, which was be able to do this, and he was able to keep it secret because, of course, if the idea had ever gotten out, then the Caltech people would have done it right away. Kellerman speculates that perhaps it was the crystallographers at Cambridge that made the radio group just think in the Fourier plane, so that it was just sort of a natural thing for them. I think it was just that Ryle was clever and even from the mid-50s realized the power of the method. Ryle at one time apparently said that the whole Cambridge budget was only equal to that of the NREO cafeteria, and that therefore they had to be much more clever, and when there were visitors and they asked you a question, don't give them more information than the quality of the question implied, but answer any questions straight. In other words, don't give out any more than you need to, and from that, somewhat the tight-lipped reputation has grown. Well, this ends the interview with Ken Kellerman and Harry Vondelon on 19 March 75.